KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. In fact, the inaugural winter 2015 edition of the show. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and this year a visiting research collaborator at the Center for Information Technology Policy at Princeton University. I am excited today to continue what I promised I would do when I said that I was getting this position, and that is to interview the many wonderful people affiliated with CITP. And so I'm excited today to be here doing a in-person, live, remote-less interview with Solon Barokas, a postdoctoral research associate at the center here, who is also writing extensively in a variety of areas of interest to listeners of Hearsay Culture. I came to Solon's work both through my own research, but also through the endorsement of a, and it's fair to say, a Hearsay Culture favorite guest. Frank Pasquale had pointed out to me that Solon's work would be very interesting for the show. As usual, Frank was right, and so I'm very excited to have Solon on today to talk about an article that he and his co-author, Andrew Selst, who was a law clerk to Judge Jane Roth on the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, have authored entitled Big Data's Disparate Impact. Big data, of course, is a phrase that we've talked about extensively on the show. It's a phrase that is both often used and also used often incorrectly and not entirely well understood, not just among policymakers and lawyers, but indeed, I think, amongst even people who think about technology. And so while there's been a lot of discussion around big data, there hasn't, I think, been enough discussion around what the actual technical impact is of big data and where we might see impact of the use of this kind of technology and algorithmic computing in areas that have not been either thought of or well thought through. And so those of you who are familiar with employment law issues and familiar with labor law hopefully picked up on the second part of that title, Disparate Impact, which is a reference to one of the causes of action and claims and theories that one can bring under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act for employment discrimination. Now, one of the hidden background pieces of information regarding my career is that while on Hearsay Culture, and in fact my scholarship that I'm doing today and I've been doing for several years, focuses on technology and intellectual property, my background is actually in labor and employment law and labor relations. My undergrad degree is in industrial labor relations from Cornell, and I represented the city of New York in labor and employment disputes when I was at the New York City Corp Counsel's office. The overlap, to the extent that it exists with intellectual property, is an interesting one because primarily it falls into the trade secrecy area, which is the area that I write in and that I advocate on, involving covenants not to compete in employee mobility. However, I have not seen an article that overlapped big data and employment discrimination and civil rights until I read Solon's and Andrew's article. In Big Data's Disparate Impact, Solon and Andrew take a hard look at how Title VII ultimately, I think in their estimation, cannot handle well the impact and use of big data. What do I mean? And we'll talk to Solon about this in more detail. When information goes into a system through any kind of algorithm, the data is put in, but as we know, oftentimes the outputs are not well understood or even predicted. And in the case of informational coding that goes on in these areas, what can happen is not only hardwiring inherent biases into the data, but also impacts of the use of that data which are not well understood and that lead either intentionally or unintentionally to the kinds of behaviors that we call discrimination. And so in the article, Solon and Andrew take a look at several examples of these situations, but also more importantly, take a hard look at what we know and what we don't know about data and the use of big data and where these hidden harms might lie. Reading the article a couple of times as I have in preparation for this interview, I can say that the contribution, as far as I can tell, is wholly unique to our understanding of big data. I've not seen this analysis done in the context of employment discrimination. discrimination. And so I'm very excited to have Solon on the show today to talk in detail about this article, which is still in draft form, but nonetheless is very well developed. So again, by way of brief background, Solon Barocas is a postdoctoral research associate at the center here at Princeton. We are recording the interview today, January 8th, 2015, in Solon's office at Princeton University on an extremely cold day, I might add. But Solon, thank you for joining us on the show and for spending time to talk with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So let me start off with a background question that I ask most of my guests. Tell us a bit more about you and how you got into this particular issue.
Sure. So right now I'm currently a postdoctoral research associate here at the Center for Information Technology Policy. I've been here for about 6 months, and prior to that, I was a doctoral student at New York University. I got my degree from the Department of Media, Culture, and Communication, and I worked with a woman named Helen Nissenbaum, who might be familiar to some listeners. She's well known for her work on privacy and other tech and philosophy issues.
And she's been on the show.
Yep. Excellent. Much of the work that that you just mentioned is a kind of a natural outgrowth of some of my dissertation work. And prior to that, I also worked for a number of years at the Russell Sage Foundation, which is a grant-making foundation, supports social science research. Got a master's degree in international relations. My bachelor's is in international relations and a kind of unusual program at Brown called Media Culture. No, what is it called? Modern Culture and Media. Kind of a media theory program. I kind of transitioned when I joined the doctoral program at NYU away from international relations, where I'd gotten my master's degree, toward this kind of tech policy stuff, in large part because I did my master's thesis on what was then a kind of recent event around total information awareness. So my master's thesis was about kind of trying to square some international relations theory on security with recent developments in technology, and specifically about total information awareness.
So I think it is a nice segue to talk about big data. It's for those listeners who aren't familiar, total information awareness sounds like something Orwellian. And so perhaps you can give us a definition of what that means.
Sure. So this was a program that I guess was initiated after September 11th and came to light in, I guess it was 2002, 2003, which was a kind of umbrella name for a series of research programs that were designed to use data mining technologies and other kind of analytic techniques to vastly increase the counterterrorism capabilities of the U.S. government. And a number of these things were very controversial, in large part because it involved using all sorts of consumer and commercial data to do risk assessments and detect terrorist networks and things of that sort. William Safire wrote a piece in the New York Times that brought this to light, and this is kind of quickly became the impetus for its unraveling. Interestingly, a lot of those programs persisted in classified parts of the government, and then years later, the kind of stuff that we've discovered because of Snowden are really kind of much more sophisticated versions of what were being conceptualized and introduced then.
So when we talk about this, before we get into the details of the article, Solon, when we talk about this idea of big data, right, its implications are varied, right? Why choose Title VII and employment discrimination as a focus, given the many uses that big data has that as you're indicating already, are not well understood?
Right. So I come from a kind of strange background where I spent a lot of time reading scholarship across various disciplines. And within the law, anyway, and within legal debates, there's been primary focus on privacy with regards to big data and other kind of information processing questions. Much less so discrimination, although it was kind of always understood as like the downstream problem which privacy was probably designed to protect against. However, in other areas that were more sociological in orientation, there has been a long-standing interest in discrimination, and a scholar in particular who's most well-known in this area is Oscar Gandhi for some kind of seminal work on the relationship between data processing and discrimination. And I kind of wanted to bridge those worlds a bit more and to dig in a bit deeper to what it means to even say that certain kinds of big data practices are discriminatory. Because it had become, especially by the time we started to write this, and even when I was working on my dissertation, it had become a common refrain. It was the kind of, you know, more pointed argument about why we should be worried about this, rather than these amorphous concerns around privacy, a much more specific threat of being discriminated against when it comes to health insurance or job prospects or, you know, educational prospects. And so for me, you know, it seemed like there was an opportunity and probably a need to introduce greater specificity into what is even meant by discrimination in that case, and how does data actually contribute to particular kinds of discrimination. So that's where it all came from.
Now, you allude to it in the article, but to further frame the discussion, when I say that things aren't well understood, that isn't to suggest, of course, as you're indicating, that there isn't a lot of work being done around it, not just among the scholarly community, but in the government as well. And so there was a recent report that came out from the executive branch that talks about big data. Perhaps you could, again, I'm not asking you to summarize an 80-page report, but sure, to give the broad construct, how does that report and really the federal government's role here fit into this work?
Yeah, so I think you're referring to the White House report, which was the result of Obama convening a set of, well, I guess he, you know, asked John Podesta to lead an effort to perform a review of big data, specifically looking at non-government uses of big data and trying to map out some policy questions and issues. And what was, I think, interesting and unique and rather remarkable about that report was the attention it paid to discrimination in particular. So it mapped out other familiar concerns around privacy and related to the fair information practices, but it was really quite novel in its focus on the risk of unintentional discrimination. And I think most readers of that report took that away as being the real contribution. And it's really very, very, I think, rapidly shifted the focus of the debate within DC, and, you know, subsequent to that report, the FTC has convened meetings on this topic as well. So yes, I mean, in a way, I was very heartened to see that this was something being taken up, and I was familiar with a number of the people who were invited to participate in the review, and I'm certain that they influenced the outcome in that way. But it was great to see that that the OSTP, the agency within the White House that was leading this review, made it this kind of front and center issue. And I had been working on this prior. The article Andrew and I prepared, you know, was probably done by the time the report came out. And so it was just, in a way, excellent timing for us, because we were able to then hand this to people and say, well, we actually can help you out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And timing, of course, is so critical, not just in scholarship, but certainly in policy. So let's pivot a little bit towards the article. Now I, you know, again, I say up front, which is why I introduce people, you are not a lawyer, but nonetheless, I'll ask you some questions. I think I can help to the extent needed, given the fact that I practice in this area. But for those that don't focus on Title VII, what is Title VII broadly? And then, really, if we focus on disparate impact and disparate treatment mm-hmm. as the two primary theories, perhaps you could describe those at least at the basic level.
Sure. So Title VII regulates employment decisions, and in particular, two doctrines have developed out of Title VII, which provide some guidance on what is appropriate or inappropriate a form of decision making when it comes to employment. And so the two doctrines are, as you mentioned, disparate treatment and disparate impact. The first, disparate treatment, is probably the more familiar one, the one that people have in mind intuitively when they think of discrimination, which is a decision maker, in this case an employer, specifically considering your gender or race or your disability status or your age or other protected features when making a decision and unfairly or unduly discounting you on that basis. So this is a conscious and willful decision to not hire you, not promote you, offer you a lower salary for reasons related to these particular features. And there's some greater detail that we maybe can get into, but the distinction, the important distinction then, is with disparate impact. And in that case, what we're focused on is not cases of intentional discrimination necessarily, but rather where what is called a facially neutral decision.
Our, all of our devices, yes.
A facially neutral decision, nevertheless having the effect of advantaging some people and systematically disadvantaging members of legally protected classes. So that's a mouthful. What that really means is, you know, an employer uses some kind of test. That test seems to suggest that men are systematically more appropriate candidates for the job than women. They didn't intend for that outcome, and yet that seems to be the outcome. And the law says, okay, well, there is an apparent disparate impact. Is this justified? And what the doctrine suggests is that employers can proffer some kind of explanation for the criteria they're considering in order to arrive at that determination. And if that has some genuine relevance to the decision, if they can demonstrate that this is actually relevant, these are relevant criteria to consider, then that decision can be justified. If, however, it's possible to show that you could arrive at a similar kind of assessment with a less disparate impact, so a decision process that would serve the same interests of the company, the employer, but minimize this disparate impact, that would be preferable, and that's really what the employer should do. So this doctrine is a way of dealing with a whole class of issues where it's not necessarily the case that the employer was consciously trying to discriminate, or even where it might be very difficult to assess or determine that the employer was discriminating.
We're chatting with Solon Barocas, postdoctoral research associate at the Center for Information Technology Policy at Princeton, on KZSU-FM and Hearsay Culture. So, Solon, maybe I should ask it this way, because I mentioned in the beginning, big data, who knows, right? What does it mean? So I'll have a follow-up question about big data broadly and the kind of discrimination you're referring to, but let's start here. What do you define big data as?
Right. So, I mean, I've always bristled at the term. I feel like I've been studying this topic well before the term became, you know, this buzzword. And for the most part, I tend to use the term data mining because for me, what really is interesting here is often much less so like the data as its own thing and much more the analysis and the kinds of applications you can develop by analyzing the data. But nevertheless, there is some value to the term. And I think it probably describes something that's worth noting, which is at a technical level, there has been interesting and important developments for a variety of reasons relating to the scale of the data, the variety of formats. This is the kind of common definition now is the one that was, I think, developed by Gartner, which is around volume, velocity, and variety. And this, from an industrial perspective, actually is maybe a useful definition because what it's referring to is that the infrastructure necessary to manage and process that information, that kind of data, is actually different than what existed prior. And so for industry, and specifically for those companies that produce those tools, this term actually seems useful. And certainly it's useful for marketing, but it's also useful to distinguish itself from what was going on before. For people who are interested in broader policy issues that are much more specifically about data involving humans and for decisions that have immediate consequences on humans' life chances, I think the infrastructure is not the issue, right? It's about the kinds of data that are now able to be collected and the kinds of decision-making it enables. And I think there's been maybe three interesting developments that probably fall under that umbrella, and I think are probably what people have in mind when they use the term, at least in policy discussions. And for me, that tends to be new ways of observing certain behavior, and that could be something as straightforward as the fact that so much is mediated digitally, and so it's producing a record of some kind of thing, just as a matter of course. The second category I tend to think about is there are now platforms which allow people to generate all sorts of new data of their own, so tweets, YouTube posts, Facebook posts, things that are not kind of structured, right? Like, you know, just narrative text or images, things that don't actually fall into some kind of predetermined category, unlike the first one I was describing. And then finally, I think there's this other area which is now becoming more familiar because of the Facebook study controversy, which is the ability for online platforms to do large-scale experiments. And I think all three of these areas are really what I suspect people have in mind when they're thinking about big data. And in particular, all three of these areas are producing data that are really useful for automating decisions in a variety of fields, and are just kind of extending this, the frontier of the kinds of problems that can be worked on through data analysis.
What's not new, right, in the big data world is that human beings are behind all of this, right? And so when I hear that that layer of three differences or what makes big data an issue, what comes to mind is if we square this with Title VII, right? Title VII, of course, you know, predates, right? It doesn't predate computing, but it certainly predates the kinds of systems that we have today, right? And obviously discrimination goes back to, you know, as far back as you go based upon your belief structures, right? What makes big data, right, problematic or challenging as a regulatory matter today? Because I can everything you're saying makes sense, right? But we have law that already deals with, right, prior to big data, right? An employer decides that they're only going to hire people that look a certain way, right? And then they go out and interview people that look that way, or less egregious than that, right? They set a physical requirement or what have you, right? That then leads to these disparate impacts, aside from, right, the disparate treatment first scenario that you mentioned, where people are literally saying and doing things directly. Big data changes the analysis from a legal perspective. How?
So I think the motivation for the paper, anyway, mm-hmm. was not to say that this was like a radically new concern or a new issue for the law. It was to say that just because decisions are now data-driven does not make them necessarily objective or fair. And so a lot of the work in the paper was to show the very subtle ways that these evidence-based processes can nevertheless have discriminatory outcomes and effects. And so in a way, it wasn't trying to point out a brand new issue. It was trying to show that even what seems to be an opportunity for significant improvement in employment decisions, right? We still need to be vigilant and careful about these processes because they're vulnerable to a variety of problems.
Mm-hmm. So that point leads to a follow-up question that you know will get us, I think, after the break into more details about what you write in the paper. You allude to what is certainly a movement towards evidence-based decision-making and policy-making, which at one level, right, and use a normative term, is a good thing to the extent that basically ad hoc decisions are being made without evidence, right? Is it fair to say that you position your paper, right, and I'm asking this in a sort of provocative way, right, in the informational skeptic community that exists, right, around not just this issue, but around technology, right? Authors and scholars who have pointed out that the internet or technology, right, or in this case, big data, is not the solution to all of the world's woes. Now, I've said it in a very hyperbolic way, but what's your reaction to that statement?
No, I mean, in a way, the paper is itself also hyperbolic, right? Okay. So we stake out, it's not an extreme position, but you know, we spend much less time highlighting the upside, which there is a significant amount, and I'll mention more in a moment. Mm-hmm. But we think because of the kind of direction of the current debate, there was a real need to have a strong counterposition that said, well, slow down, we actually need to think more carefully about this. Let me just say, specifically in employment, the opportunity for improvement by using data to drive certain kinds of decision-making is significant, and I've written about that elsewhere. You know, there's just unbelievably high rates of discrimination in employment against minorities. I mean, black men in particular face an unbelievably high, they're penalized at such a high rate, it's horrible. And so, you know, data can, I think, really begin to address some of these decisions, some of these problems, but it's not itself a cure-all, and it doesn't just by its nature solve that problem. Right?
And so, before the break, this is you've set up the segue to the question, which contextualizes all of it. You just alluded to, right, examples. Do you want to? This would be a good time, I think, to offer a couple of examples of the kinds of data-driven problems that you and your co-author have identified in the paper.
Sure. So the paper kind of tries to map out a taxonomy of of issues that relate to the data mining process. So what I should just say very quickly is that the way to actually turn data into some kind of useful evidence base is through what is called, in the kind of commercial realm, data mining. And within computer science is generally referred to as machine learning. And these are computational techniques that allow you to automate the analysis of the data to do a variety of things. Part of it can be to just discover certain kinds of patterns in the data set, but frequently it's used to be able to generate predictive models that relate some kind of criteria to a specific thing you want to know, like, you know, how well will this person do when it comes to sales at the end of the month, or can I predict this person's tenure with the company? And in general, what's very useful about these approaches is that it allows the employer, the business, to build these models without having to actually hypothesize themselves what those criteria are, right? They simply say, we know from history that these are the people who've tended to stay a long time, and we'll just let the computer tell us what tends to be the things that predict their tenure. Okay, so with that in mind, the process of undertaking this kind of analysis, there are a number of opportunities for things to kind of go awry, and maybe arising the wrong. It's just actually difficult to execute this well, because so much of the process actually involves careful judgment making, and I'll try to give some concrete examples. So one is, we try to think about, you know, how is it that employers decide who to hire? Well, they want to hire a good employee, right? Well, in this case, you actually have to be very specific about what good means, right? And in the scholarship and within the field, what this is referred to as setting the target variable. What is it specifically that you want to predict? And so good needs to be translated into something measurable, right? And the examples we offer are like sales, tenure, you know, what kind of feedback the person who works at the call center receives from the people they interact with. Something that has a specific value. And only by associating good with some kind of specific formal definition that can be measured, can you develop these models. And in that very basic sense, you're actually, at a very fundamental level, deciding what it is that you're even trying to solve, right? What it is that you're trying to optimize for. At the very start of this process, decision makers working with data miners have to settle on this really, I think, complex definition. And this has consequences for a variety of consequences. And so just to refer to the examples I mentioned already, you know, choosing to hire based on predicted tenure, which is really important for high turnover jobs like call center workers or low wage labor, that can have a serious consequences for the kinds of people you end up hiring, right? It may well be that certain populations have higher turnover for reasons that have to do with socioeconomic status, right? It may be sensible from the point of view of the business, but do we actually want that decision-making process to systematically disadvantage certain people, right? So at the very most basic level, I think those are some of the questions. But it gets more complicated still. So as I mentioned, this process is kind of learning from examples. The way it gets there is it says, can we look at historical evidence to predict the future? What are the patterns and the set of examples we have? Well, assembling that set of examples is a fraught process in a number of ways. One is it's sometimes really challenging to collect a set of examples that capture the full range of the population you want to deal with. And so there's a number of important examples here. The more well-known one is one that Kate Crawford, a scholar at Microsoft Research, is well known for kind of bringing to people's attention. It's about the Boston mayor's office use of or development of this app called Street Bump, where the idea was to try to kind of crowdsource the detection of potholes by allowing people to install a little app on their phone, which using the phone's built-in accelerometer would notice when you go over a uneven part of the road and would automatically then report the GPS location of that bump, right? Really clever, seems like a very cost-effective way of doing things, involves citizens and, you know, reporting back important issues. Well, what Kate points out is, you know, ownership of smartphones is actually very uneven. Certain populations may not be able to afford them. More than that, certain populations might not even know this app exists. And so because of a variety of structural reasons, it may be that you get information back from this app that is reflecting, you know, the predominantly wealthy, technically savvy population. And so the city is getting lots of information about certain parts of the city where those people happen to live, and almost no information about the other parts of the city where people who don't have phones or are unaware of the app live. And so using information where there's this, you know, and the statistical term for this would be a reporting bias, using that to drive decision-making can have serious consequences, right? Like, we shouldn't allow the city to decide where to invest in repairs based on highly skewed data sets. And this is a general phenomenon, right? That decision-making of this sort and data mining in general is going to be vulnerable to this kind of problem. Another example relates less so to the collection of data and more to determining what is even an example of the thing you want to learn. And this, I think, is well explained by a piece of research that LaTanya Sweeney did. She's a computer scientist at Harvard, more recently at the FTC, where she discovered that distinctly black-sounding names were more likely to... Sorry, let me start again. When performing searches on Google, if you were to enter a distinctly black-sounding name in comparison to a distinctly white-sounding name, the distinctly black-sounding name would be more likely to be shown alongside... The results would be more likely to be shown alongside ads by companies that perform background checks. And in particular, the ad would have text something like, arrest record question mark, suggestive of an arrest record. And when LaTanya was kind of told about this by a colleague, because the colleague actually discovered this by searching for LaTanya's own name, LaTanya was somewhat incredulous and then went and did the study to say, like, this can't really be true, and actually discovered that, in fact, it was. And so it's a really great piece of scholarship and research. And one of the important things that LaTanya did was that she found out that the companies whose ads were being shown didn't actually set out to do this. They didn't pay to target by specific names or even by race or
ethnicity. So this was not a keyword advertising type situation.
It was keyword in the sense that they probably were trying to show ads relating to names, generally.
Okay.
But it wasn't that it was keyed to any particular name.
I see.
Right. One of the important features of the way Google determines what to show alongside search results isn't just how much the advertiser is willing to pay to show that ad. Google actually does something quite clever. It looks at the history of people who have been exposed to the ad and how many times people who have been exposed to that click on it. They basically want to see, does it get a lot of attention? And those ads that actually get clicked on more frequently will be the ads that get shown, in part because it's in the interest of Google, because they get paid if the ad gets clicked on, and it's probably in the interest of the advertiser too. And so there's this natural process whereby things that already have some amount of attention in comparison to others will kind of bubble up further to the top. So this dynamic means then that user input matters to what is being shown. And in particular here, what it could mean is that people were more likely to click on the ad if the ad was keyed to a distinctly black-sounding name than if it was for a distinctly white-sounding name. And what that probably suggests is that the process is kind of reflecting back the prejudice that people have or the implicit bias that people have who are exposed to the ad. Mm-hmm. And so this is an important dynamic which shows that it's very easy for some of these processes to inherit or to simply reflect back the kinds of prejudice and bias involved in people's decision-making. And I know that there's maybe one other example along these lines that's helpful. So you can imagine an employer who wants to automate the process of hiring people, and it says, why don't we just look at all the people that we think of as being great candidates, right? And why don't we just go and see what are those features about those people that seem to correlate with their performance, right? Seems sensible, great way to kind of sort through resumes, let's say. Well, one of the problems with that as a process is that you can only learn about the kinds of people that you've hired in the past, right? You're going to learn what's great about the specific people that you had the, you know, foresight to hire previously. What you won't learn is that there are many other candidates who you have no contact with because you didn't consider them in the past, about whom you can therefore never make good assessments in the future, right? And so in that sense, it's again kind of inheriting the bias that had been involved in prior decision making, right? If you don't have examples to learn from, you'll never know that there'd be good people to look at elsewhere, right? And so these processes are vulnerable to a number of these subtle problems, and just using data as a way to drive these decision making processes doesn't mean we escape them.
That point is where we'll take a very quick break. We're chatting with Solon Barocas of Princeton's Center for Information Technology Policy on KZSU-FM Stanford. For those of you that have listened to the show, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways that you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu or go to our webpage and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope you continue to listen both to the station and to Hearsay Culture. So you did a great job there of laying out some of these issues, and particularly the examples that you talk about in the paper. When we get into a bit of the weeds of Title VII, there's one issue that immediately came to mind with me, and you talk about them in the paper that I think is worth spending time on, and it's one that lawyers and people that focus on law might think about. You point at him, and we should start here. Yeah, clearly, some, if not most, of what you're referring to are unintended consequences, as you point out, of otherwise clever or good ideas, right? So your speed bump example, but really all of them, in a manner of speaking, might be that, although the Google example you use is, I think, by far the most disturbing one, and one that appropriately, as you've indicated, has been investigated, I'm sure will continue to be investigated. But at any rate, let's assume for the moment that all of these situations involve, to some extent, unintended consequences of, right? The law doesn't handle those situations well, I think, generally. Right? There's long bodies of law in most areas that focus on questions of mens rea and intent and trying to figure out what people actually mean. Right? I teach contracts, and my contract students hear me say endlessly, right, that human beings are imperfect communicators, and we spend our time trying to figure out what people mean with using words, and the speakers themselves are not sure what those words mean, and they don't write well. All of that's by way of saying, right? And you talk about this in the paper. Tell us about your views of how you square these kinds of proven impacts of data with the problem that the perpetrators, if you will, right, or the people, right, as I mentioned earlier, behind these ultimate impacts, right, I think treatment we might handle differently a little bit, aren't aware that this is happening or didn't intend it.
Right. Yeah. No. So you already kind of hinted at what I was going to answer, which is I think it's clear, and this is what we argue in the paper, that disparate treatment doctrine, which to remind listeners, you know, is about this kind of intentional discrimination where you consider factors you're not supposed to, that doctrine, that strategy really is probably not going to be applicable here. There are, of course, let me just mention very quickly, many clever ways that you could use these same methods to discriminate intentionally and to hide the fact that you've done it. But what we're trying to argue in the paper is that we imagine that most of the actors who are clever enough to use these techniques are not going to be the ones who also want to purposefully discount qualified candidates, let's just say. It's not impossible, but I think for the most part, it's much more likely that these subtle problems are producing all sorts of unintentional effects that culminate in, I think, a really worrisome outcome. So if disparate treatment is not the way to approach this, then it seems to suggest that disparate impact is, right? Well, disparate impact also may not offer us a huge amount of help here, in part because one of the defining features of the doctrine is the question, is this decision considering relevant criteria? And if so, then it's justified. Well, what's interesting about data mining is that it only discovers relevant features, right? The whole point of using the technique is to have the computer tell you, here are the things that you should be looking at, right? So it seems hard to imagine cases where you can successfully sue showing that a data mining process is not considering things that are relevant. But, of course, as we just discussed, there are a variety of reasons why the discoverer relationship might not be true, right? For reasons having to do with the way the problem is defined, how the data is collected, how the examples are assembled, and other issues we mentioned in the paper. But those might not be either recognized by the decision makers, even regulators who would be in position to kind of press them to think about it, might not be able to offer practical advice about how to recognize them. And finally, even if we were able to find out that there are, in fact, problems of these sorts, how to remedy them, how to actually compensate for those problems or eliminate them is oftentimes not obvious. And so it actually amounts to a pretty unfortunate situation, we think. And you know, we worry that the paper's overly pessimistic because there probably is, and we'll certainly write more about ways to overcome some of these problems. But generally speaking, you know, it doesn't seem that the existing law, at least in this area, really has a lot to offer when the problem is unintentional discrimination for reasons having to do with the issues I described previously.
Yeah, I want to ask you, although, as you just said, not the primary focus of the paper, but at least your thoughts on where we might look for solutions. But before we get there, coming back to this issue of unintended consequences, right? You refer to in the paper, and you alluded to a little bit here, that in a sense, data sets learn from themselves. That's a confusing concept for most people, and you've alluded to it, but I think it's important to understand. Explain that for our listeners.
Sure. Okay. So, the point of contrast that might be helpful here is distinguishing between, let's say, a decision-making process which someone devises by hand or in discussion. You know, let's say we're recruiters, we want to figure out how to weed through resumes. Well, we decide, like, we want them to have this qualification, and we want them to have this many years of experience, and it would be great if they, you know, have some specialization in this area, whatever. That's what they use to sort. That's how the decision was determined. In contrast, imagine a situation where you do this almost in the reverse order. You say, let's go look at the people we've hired previously who've proven themselves really competent, you know, great employees. And let's go and look at the information we have about those people. And you put together a database that just has all the information you have about all candidates, and you have information about whether those candidates are what you would consider good or bad, right? Simple categorical distinction. And then you use algorithms, this is where the machine learning comes in, use algorithms to help automate the process of discovering which features happen to be those most highly correlated with the good employees and which happen to be most highly correlated with the bad employees. And that is what is the decision-making rule, right? It's the discovery of those things which happen to best predict good or best predict bad. And in that way, no one actually consciously set out to say, you know, credentials are what matter. It could end up being that many other things which are not obvious, and this is really where the value lies, many non-intuitive factors actually end up being highly predictive of job performance. And so this approach is now used everywhere. I mean, it's used to make predictions about the kinds of interest you'll have in online advertising. It's the basis for credit scoring, but also for new ways of doing credit scoring in alternative ways. It's the driving force behind, many of the major internet companies. And what's interesting, I think, is that there's an enormous amount of human involvement, as I was trying to describe, in the way you kind of undertake this process. But it's very different from this traditional way of kind of writing a set of rules by hand. And so that's what I'm trying to emphasize when I say, you know, the kind of data leads to the decision making.
So we're running into what I call the unfair portion of the show. unfair for you, not for me, because we have about 10 minutes left, sure. And I'll start asking you questions that you may not feel you have adequate time to answer, okay. But then I do the unfair thing and ask them anyway. As you're talking about correlations, and before we get to, you know, at least your early thoughts on solutions, I was trying to remember the name of it as you were talking, but there's a very funny website that appeared about a year ago, it's called something along the lines of absurd correlations, but basically it points out, you know, what you know, people often forget, but many people know, right, that causation or correlation doesn't equal causation. And it has funny stuff where they pick random data, right, and so it turns out that the, you know, the average temperature in Nebraska in March correlates to the number of people that die in a, you know, that are assassinated in another part of the world, you know, stuff like this. Here's my point, right? Is there a risk in the data mining world of disparate impact of having the causation not equal to cause the correlation? In other words, right, that one could conclude from an output, right, that is discriminatory, that the data set is flawed or the coding is flawed, when in fact there isn't a correlation. Is that a problem which is eliminated by virtue of the fact that you're dealing with data sets, or is it one that takes on a different hue?
If I think I understand the yeah. question, so what I'll say is I want to make sure that I acknowledge that many of the people working in this field are actually very clever, mm-hmm. and they are sensitive to the various ways that their model building can go wrong. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so they don't do what their method wouldn't produce these kind of absurd correlations yeah. that this website.
Let me be clear about that then. So I didn't ask the question. I don't mean the scholars. I mean the people who are actually putting the data in. In other words, is there a risk from the user side? Right, you're studying it as an expert in the field, uh-huh. but I'm thinking about it in terms of, for example, the individuals who put in speed bump, right?
Right.
You've identified, or I should say, other scholars have identified this issue. You're amplifying it. Is there a risk that in the absence of understanding what the implications are of data mining and big data, that one, and this gets back to the intent issue, that we could create a scenario where people are almost chilled or there is a concern about using data sets because if there is an impact that looks bad, right, and I'm being a bit vague here, right, I don't want to deal with it, and yet within the data set, an expert like yourself or others would see that actually the concern that you've raised or the concern you see from the output doesn't relate to the data itself. Does that, maybe that's a better way to
put it. No, I think I see what you're saying. Yeah. And yeah, I think that, you know, knowing that for reasons that are even larger than the ones we discussed here, I think knowing that decision-making processes that really can affect your life chances are being driven by certain kinds of data can, first of all, like, you know, chill certain behavior, but can also suggest, you know, that maybe there's opportunities to, you know, adjust your behavior to try to accommodate the strict expectations of the system. And so, you know, one version of this is a fear of gaming, but another is that, like, these have consequences that are really about kind of the interaction between the people subject to some decision and the data they're producing and the data that's observed by others. And so, you know, we need to understand that this is actually a situated process where people are, you know, agents. They're not just passive generators of data that are then, you know, subject to some decision. They'll adapt their behavior. And so I think we need to think about these things as being really very different than, you know, modeling some kind of physical process. And generally speaking, I still think the point I was going to make earlier is relevant here, which is that practitioners in the field who are, you know, either well-trained or have, you know, a lot of experience would be sensitive to a lot of these problems. And generally speaking, would try to compensate for them or at least caution the decision makers that rely on them to not see this as an infallible decision-making tool, right? Mm-hmm. To avoid the kind of hubris that might come from a sense that this is like an objective, unquestionable process.
And so that will lead us, again, unfair questions. Double unfair, because not only are we short on time, but again, I am sensitive to the fact that you're not a lawyer. Doesn't mean you can't talk about the law, of course, but I do want to ask you this, since there are many lawyers that listen. So to the extent that Title VII, right, as you've indicated, doesn't handle these situations well, and also recognizing even more caveats that this isn't the primary focus of the paper, early thoughts on, from a policy and lawmaking perspective, what we might look for to at least think about to address these concerns that you've raised in Title VII and in employment and civil rights law generally?
Yeah, so we didn't get into it, but I think there's another part of the paper which is really even more troubling, even more difficult, which actually has to do not with when the process kind of goes wrong in the way it describes,
yeah.
but when, in fact, the process kind of discovers that there's serious inequality in society
yeah.
and that these decision-making procedures can just become especially sensitive to that inequality and then either reproduce it or even exacerbate it.
That's your two-right scenario.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. And in that case, man, that's like a profound conundrum, both, I think, politically and legally. But for the other things that we discussed, I think there actually are opportunities here, right? Becoming more sensitive to how these things can go awry, these kinds of issues around the collection of the data, how the data is labeled, what it is that you're even specifying as the thing you care about predicting. You know, greater sensitivity to those problems can be incentivized through either regulatory pressure of some sort, actual changes in the law. You know, the EEOC might not have authority to do anything, but they can certainly use their convening power to generate some kind of attention for these issues, right? And so my sense is that even if there aren't necessarily always obvious solutions to these problems, because it may not be possible to, you know, collect all the information you want, sensitizing decision makers to this process is, I think, eminently possible, and government absolutely can play a role in it. So that's definitely one area. And I'll just say very quickly, yeah, the right. other area, which is what I'm involved with now increasingly, is trying to develop ways of ensuring some kind of fairness defined in a variety of ways at a computational level. How mm-hmm. do you bring to bear computer science to actually make sure that this decision procedure meets or obeys some kind of fairness standard?
Well, I think, and we do have a few minutes left here, Solon. I'm not changing the rules. It's still unfair. Two-right, the system, you just alluded to it, and I thought you alluded to it a little bit as well, but I want to be clear about this because you're right. I think it's probably equally problematic for different reasons. What is the things go two-right? To be clear, that's T-O-O, right, in data mining.
Okay, so...
We have about 4 minutes.
Okay, so yeah. This, I think, comes from, it grows out of a concern that certain decisions, while they may not consider these factors that are legally prescribed, so they're not considering race or gender or age, they're considering factors that are really correlated with those factors. So the traditional example of this is zip code is an almost perfect substitute in many cases for race. And so considering zip code is a way to basically consider race by proxy. And so this entire concern is basically described as, you know, a fear around the use of proxies. But in that case, it can be pretty obvious that this is just a front, right? This is just a way of concealing that you're actually trying to discriminate on the basis of race. But in many situations, it will be far more complicated. There can be many factors in combination rather than one factor that is perfectly correlated, but many factors in combination that nevertheless happen to be a good predictor of race and simultaneously a good predictor of the thing you care about, right? And if you take this to an extreme, especially in cases with very rich data sets, what you'll basically discover is that it's impossible to suppress the information communicated by this thing that you're not supposed to consider, right? My gender, my race, my age, my disability status will be reflected across the, you know, thousands and thousands of factors that a lot of these processes now consider, to the point that whether or not you consider that fact is irrelevant because you're basically learning everything else anyway. So the issue here is at a kind of legal and philosophical level, one that's very hard to resolve, because what you need to kind of ask is how correlated does something need to be for it to be illegitimate? And there's probably not going to be an obvious answer. And really what this, I think, reflects is that the distinction between the doctrines we describe is ultimately very hard to uphold, which has been something that both practicing lawyers and legal scholars have commented on for years, but that will be a especially acute problem in the case of data mining, because it will simply dissolve this distinction between decisions that do not and distinctions that somehow that do not consider legally prescribed features, and these super rich data sets, which allow you to basically reconstitute that feature just in the process of trying to determine something. So I'll just end by saying that two right means that a decision-making process can be evidence-driven based on accurate, rich, useful information, but end up having a highly disparate impact, largely because it's discovered that there is profound inequality in society. And decisions that, you know, are as mundane as advertising might not be so worrisome, but when those things end up being the basis for employment, for health, for insurance, whatever it might be, you know, we really want to begin to ask, like, should these mechanisms be allowed to kind of perpetrate this further entrenching of inequality where historically marginalized populations are already in a much less favorable position?
Solon Barocas, postdoctoral research associate at the Center for Information Technology Policy at Princeton. So many times I say this, this is no exception. You are certainly invited back because we have only touched the tip of the iceberg, and this strikes me as a research vein that you could spend several years on easily, and still there'd be questions. Nonetheless, the article that you've co-authored with Andrew Selbst, Big Data's Disparate Impact, available on SSRN, and soon to be published. Thank you so much for joining us on the show. This issue is both troubling and fascinating, but I thank you for taking the time today to talk to my guests.
Thank you so much. It was great.
So the beginning of the quarter, of course, even though it is literally in the single digits today, we have a lot to look forward to this semester. A number of guests coming up on the show, some of whom are also here at Princeton. Zia Meon and Alex Glazer, co-authors of a book on a new theory for dealing with nuclear proliferation, will be on the show later on in this quarter. I'm also going to be having another CITP scholar who's right around the corner here, Arvind Narayan, who will be talking about his fascinating work. Lisa Lynch, who was here this past semester, will be on the show talking about her work on WikiLeaks and leak sites generally, and many other guests coming on the show very soon. I believe the next guest, and the schedule is being set now, but I believe the next guest will be Biela Coleman on her book on Anonymous. So, as always, you have a number of ways to listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen, and I actually, as I record this today on, again, January 8th, 2015. I do not know exactly when the show is going to air this quarter on KZSU, but it will be on, so you can listen to it there live. You can stream KZSU live at kzsulive.stanford.edu, or you can get the show via podcast by going to the Center for Internet and Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, or you can go to hearsayculture.com. I have mentioned, and I'll mention it again, that the site is going through a massive overhaul, primarily driven by the fact that the site has been under persistent attack by hackers over the last 3 years. And so I have a wonderful group of volunteers who are terrific people and terrific experts who are working on not only hardening the website, but really overhauling it from both a functionality as well as an appearance standpoint. So look for a new launch website in late February. Meanwhile, you can always email me with comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. So thank you for joining me today on the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.